Hi, my name is Ben Armstrong.
Hi, this is David Koch.
My name is Thomas Maurer.
Hi, I'm Donna Sarkar.
Hi, my name is Lana Montgomery.
Hi, I'm Seth Warres.
Hi, I'm Aaron Thomas.
I'm Jess Dodson.
Hi, I'm Rocky Heckman.
Hi, I'm Sonia Cuff.
Hi, I'm Troy Hunt.
Hello, this is Wally Mead.
My name is Reid Purvis.
Hi, I'm Lars Flynn.
Hi, my name is Alan Birchall.
Hi, I'm Adam Fowler.
Hi, I'm Sky Guthrie, and you're listening to the Need to Know podcast.
All the latest Microsoft Cloud news, as well as industry guest deep dive conversations. It's the Need to Know podcast, all thanks to Rode Microphones. The Need to Know podcast. Catch us on Twitter and Facebook, NGK Podcast, and online at podcasts.needtoknow.cloud.
And we're back for another episode of the Need to Know podcast. It has been a while since our last episode, and luckily Brenton has stuck around and joined me once again for episode 204. Welcome, Brenton.
Good to be back, Robert.
This has been a bit of a break. I took a bit of a trip overseas to the MVP Summit and decided that it's probably better to have all our audio recording equipment and producing equipment in one place, which would give the audience a better result. So we decided to hold off for a week or two. And as such, we've now have a large backlog of news to get through. So that's what we thought we'd focus on for this episode. But while I've been away, Brenton, what have you been doing?
I got asked to speak at the National Cybersecurity Conference. I forget which one, but it's the biggest one in the country. And I was quite honored to be asked. They're particularly looking for speakers around small business security. There's plenty of information out there for the enterprise. The Australian Cybersecurity Centre is always going, you know, enterprise, we're trying to help them, but, you know, they've got it sorted, they've got resources, they're thinking about it. It's the small businesses that they're working with that are the biggest threat vector in their opinion. So they're really looking for leaders to step up. So people like Robert and myself to step up and try and help people through this murky cybersecurity landscape for small business. So that's what I've been excited about.
Okay, so when is that? Give us a bit more detail on when the event is, where it is, and all that sort of stuff.
I think it's not for a while. I think it's like October, something like that. It will be in Melbourne. They're just confirming the speakers up at the moment. It was quite an honour to be asked.
Well, yeah, that's great. So again, we'll make sure that when you do get the information, we'll let you know. We'll speak more about it, obviously, as we get down to closer to the date. But that's excellent. Have you picked a topic? Do they want you to speak about a topic in particular at all?
Well, I'm going to talk about mainly the conflict between IT and cybersecurity. I've put it in the notes here, but Robert's a very big advocate of this as well, but it's not good enough just to say, well, now you have our Office 365, off you go. Security is far more than that. You need to actually configure you need to turn things on, you need to actually understand what you're doing. And that's been one of the great things that we're working through on the Patreon group, lots of people asking questions about email security in particular and how modern auth works and how legacy auth works. And that was one of the things that's really been lighting up the forum while you've been away, Robert.
Well, I've still had access to the Facebook and the group there with the patron, thanks to the roaming data inclusion in my mobile plan. So it's been good, but you're right. The reality is that understanding what basic auth is, understanding what modern auth is, and many people confuse the fact that by simply turning on multi-factor authentication that you're 100% secure. Well, when you do that by default, basic authentication will still be enabled. It allows things like app passwords. Now, if you don't want to do app passwords, if you want to get away from the normal password, login and password screen and actually go through this new modern authentication, which is web-based, then you need to run a bit of PowerShell to turn that off. That makes your tenant that much more secure. But the important thing, like Brenton mentions, is to remember that some of this stuff remains on even by default. So you have to, again, go in and make sure that you turn a lot of this stuff off. And I think one of the stories that we've got here to talk about is basically an article that indicates that, again, when you only accept the defaults with Office 365, then, again, it's probably not as secure from things like phishing as you would potentially expect. So have you had a look at that article, Brenton?
Yeah, I think you're talking about the one that I'm thinking about. But before we jump to that, I want to grab the one right from the end of the articles here that an MVP has written up. And he's written down some really good examples of things that he's come across that really grabs his attention. So I'll give you an example. A university I worked with didn't realize what Office 365 groups were until half the year. And after the functionality was made available, by that stage, students had created hundreds of groups with all sorts of names, some inappropriate, and it happened again when they rolled out Microsoft Teams. So he's got a whole bunch of like interesting gotchas from people administrating Office 365, obviously not podcast listeners, because you've demonstrated that you invest constantly in yourself. But there's a lot of things you need to know in order to do things properly. And I got a bit of a laugh out of this because I've come across a few of these myself, and I'm sure you have too, Robert.
Yeah, so I think the world record I've seen in tenants that I, or customers I've dealt with, is basically 73 teams. Within that 73 teams was five teams that were all called accounts, and this was in a three-person business. Wow. So having the ability to do this quite easily, again, has a trade-off that it can cause issues. And as with any IT, a bit of design work, a bit of thought up front, and this is where the reseller can generally go in and provide that guidance. Again, you can do things well, but you can also do them poorly, and a lack of understanding can cause problems. And it can also make you slightly, you know, potentially more insecure, because again, you don't, many average users don't understand some of the ramifications of creating teams that also does things like creates an email account, which then may be a sinkhole for things like phishing and that and so on. So again, this is where the value add is to make sure that you do understand the product, and hopefully resellers out there can provide that value add to the product.
Now, I remember there was a big hack on Big Enterprise a while ago where they go in and open a ticket with the company, and the ticket would assign them an email address right down to that ticket. It's something that a lot of ticket systems do natively. And then via that email, they'll be able to register with a Slack account using that email. Slack would send them a password, and then they'd get into Slack and start exfiltrating data. So really understanding how these products work at the base level and how they authenticate and what sort of access people have to different things, particularly when you're starting to open your tenant up to external users. I think this is one of the things Microsoft does really well, and the fact that there's an audit log and there are controls to lock this stuff down, whereas, you know, in other products, those controls aren't necessarily there, particularly smaller niche players who are just like, it's either everything or nothing, or you have no idea where people are logging in from. There's no way to lock them out if they're out of the country, or, you know, conditional access, all of that sort of stuff. So, yeah, so it's a very, very interesting landscape that we're in at the moment.
And I think part of it is like any IT system, even on-prem, you had to, again, there was a best practice to apply around to lock things down, turn things off, reduce basically the footprint to improve security. That doesn't change because the technology moves to the cloud. Microsoft's about enabling things, but it certainly gives you the controls to go in there and disable things which don't make sense. So another one that I always highlight is most mailbox accounts these days don't need POP and IMAP, and that should be turned off. So I had another instance of an environment that someone had used IMAP connectivity to a common shared style mailbox and was then sending emails out that the customer didn't really understand where it was coming from. So again, a simple PowerShell script would have basically closed all of the POP3 and IMAP ports off for those mailboxes to remove access. So again, a lot of basics you can do. One of the things that we develop in the patron community is a best practice approach. We script that so that people can then run that and make that as secure as possible. And we also give people the education and the discussion around what makes sense and what doesn't make sense. So I had an interesting incident myself when I looked at my logs, or I got a warning that said an email address for a user had failed to log into my tenant, and I didn't recognize the email address. Then when I went and had a look in my cloud app security, Yes, that was the case, but then I found that I'd also logged in successfully. That made me a bit worried, as why did an email address that I didn't recognize and wasn't in my AD, to my knowledge, able to log in successfully. And then I ran on my PowerShell scripts, and then I wrote some more PowerShell scripts to double check things at a lower level, eventually worked out what the issue was. And again, that was not an incident, but again, it was an education for me to understand, okay, so in this case, this is what happened. This is why the alarm was tripped. Okay, so it was good that it did happen. So again, there's a lot you can do by default, which you should be doing as a best practice, and then you can add on additional licenses, as Brenton says, so things like Azure ADP 1 for conditional access, Cloud App Security is another one, so there's a whole range of products, and then you can integrate that even further with things like Windows Defender ATP, and obviously you want to make sure that you've got things like Office 365 ATP, which again will basically sandbox your emails as they come in, amongst a number of other things. And I suppose it might be appropriate, since we've mentioned that, to talk about the new SKUs with Office 365 ATP. So are you across these changes, Brenton?
I am not. There's no link in our notes here for me to have a look. So I'll be, there isn't one. So I'll be very reliant on you explaining the differences between these two new SKUs, why you think they've come about, and what benefit you think they'll bring to customers.
So at the end of the day, the idea was that Office 360, so let's take a step back. There are a lot of ATP products in the Microsoft suite. So there's Azure ATP, there's Microsoft ATP, there's a whole range of stuff, but one we're focusing on here is something called Office 365 ATP. Now what that does basically is it will sandbox any attachment which comes in, open it in a virtual machine in the Microsoft data centers, make sure that it's clean, and then take action based on that. Now, previously there was simply one Office 365 ATP. So there was that which was also included in plans like Microsoft 365 Business, which made it a real bonus add-on to that SKU. What they've done is they've basically split this into two Office 365 ATP plans, plan one and plan two. So the first one is the original, the standard one that we're used to with things like Microsoft 365 Business. ATP plan two was formerly known as Threat Intelligence. So basically what this takes is plan one, all the features, all the sandboxing, the link whitelisting and so on, and then adds things like threat trackers. It adds the ability to do advanced threat investigation. You can also do an attack simulation, which means you can basically try and phish your own users and get reports to see who clicked and didn't click. And again, it has a lot of the advanced features that used to be only part of the threat intelligence in the E5 plan. So if you want, you can add this plan to onto any license, but again, you still get the option for ATP as well. So that's sort of the differences in a nutshell there.
So I'd be correct in saying that the original ATP is still there. It still works as good as ever. It still has the same features in it, but they've added another ATP plan, which brings in some of the great things about E5. If you only need a few things out of E5 and not everything, and adds them into the capability of advanced threat protection. Would that be a fair assessment?
Yeah, basically. So if, again, you look at the link, which I've now posted in the OneNote, so Brenton can examine it.
I can see that now. Thank you.
Is that, again, the E5 plan used to include threat trackers, threat explorer, automated investigation response and attack simulator, and they've now put that into plan two. Plan one, as Brenton mentioned, has all the good things like safe attachments, safe links, anti-phishing policies, protection for OneDrive, Teams and SharePoint, and real-time reporting. So again, if you've got ATP already, you'll be getting typically an upgrade to plan one. If you want to go further but not go to the expense of buying the full E5 license, then you can certainly go to ATP plan two. It would seem at this case that ATP plan two will not be added to something like Microsoft 365 Business. We're waiting on confirmation of that, but Microsoft 365 Business already includes ATP plan one. And for most people, that's more than enough. Of course, I don't think many small businesses are going to pay for people to go in and track things down to the nth degree. They just want to get on with their job. So the main thing is to be aware of that there are now two ATP plans. Most plans that already have it will stay on the plan one, but there now is a plan two with some advanced features. If you do want to go into that, we'll put the link in the show notes that so that people can review it. So I think that's going to be a handy thing, but Like I said, there is a bit of confusion around what is ATP, and again, there are a couple of different flavors of it, but we're talking about Office 365 ATP here.
Yeah, and I think that leads really nicely into our next article here, where a bit of a headline grabber, one of the patrons put it up, grabbed my attention, that's for sure. And it was 25% of phishing emails bypass Office 365 default security. So to clarify, when we say default security, this is you buy an Office 365 subscription and you point mail at it. You have done nothing to run PowerShell or to configure policies or turn on advanced threat protection. This is basically you go put an Exchange Plan 1 on it. It comes with this thing called EOP, which is Exchange Online Protection, which is great. When we're talking about something like a phishing email, it's not like a virus. It's a different sort of thing. So, were you surprised at this, Robert?
No, I think that like with any email systems, that the bad actors are out there. They're basically going to spin up a demo tenant themselves. They're going to analyze it to the nth degree, then work out the best way to get around the standard settings based on the fact that a lot of people won't change the standard settings. So, again, just because this report comes out does indicate that you've got active people out there working out ways to get around this sort of protection, and it's a cat and mouse sort of environment where the Microsoft makes a change and then the bad actors will then react and try and work a way around it. So it's not a fixed thing. It's never going to be perfect no matter what you do, but you can certainly improve that dramatically by making some standard changes, by implementing things like DKIM and DMARC, which again make big impact on the way that emails are scored and addressed when it comes to phishing and spam. So the simple message is yes, the protection does work out of the box, but it can be made so much better with a few tweaks and a few best practices. So again, not surprising, but the recommendation I think is for all environments to make sure that they do look at it and configure it and make sure they have set it up the way to minimize the attacks and also the spam coming into their environment. Not difficult. And again, if you're a reseller, you can do this in a systematic way using scripts. So again, not a surprise, and hopefully more people take this on board and look at, again, making sure that they have locked it down as best they can.
I think it's a good conversation to have with your customers. It goes back to the antivirus conversation. I see EOP is very much an antivirus. It will stop 100% of known viruses. People go, that's fantastic. And it's like, well, that's not what you have to worry about anymore. Similar to how your antivirus works, it stops pretty much all known viruses now. Once they know about it, they stop it. But people aren't getting compromised just with known viruses. They're getting compromised with things that haven't been seen before. Or it's a phishing scam where it's like, hey, can you send me some information? EOP is not really designed to do that. So that's why we have ATP, and that's why Microsoft's bundling it in with things like Microsoft 365 to really drive adoption of this technology. Because, you know, it looks here out of the box that G Suite is doing a better job of stopping phishing. But this is, we're talking about out of the box configuration. As far as I know, there's no G Suite, ATP or anything to that effect. I'm not an expert in G Suite, but I don't know if there's any add-ons you can get. Whereas in Microsoft, they give you that power and that ability to change things or to, you know, figure out, well, if I'm getting attacked all the time with people from Nigeria, let's flag emails that have the word Nigeria in it, because that's not something we'd normally talk about in our business. You can do that all the way into your tenant. And yes, it takes time to set up, but if it can protect someone from sending $100,000 to China by accident or on purpose, but not meant to, then, you know, that's going to pay for itself in the long run, isn't it?
I think also, too, you look at the obvious. So another obvious one to me, besides setting off POP and IMAP, is why not block emails from countries that you're very much unlikely to have correspondence from? So again, you can block them by language. So if you don't receive Russian or Croatian or Indonesian language emails, then it makes sense to block those as you know, a way to reduce your surface area when it comes to attack. So again, just simple things like that applied consistently can make a huge amount of difference. And again, there is a range of things that you can apply, but once you've worked it out, you can generally script it and apply on a regular basis. And that's one of the benefits that we bring in our patron community, is that people who join that can get access to that group intelligence and then apply it into new tenants as well as existing tenants, and again, get the benefits of that. So best practice when it comes to email, best practice when it comes to Office 365 ATP, setting up DKIM, DMARC, all of that sort of stuff. Is very important. And again, if you're not familiar with it, do some research, look at some of the links that we've listed there, and then again, invest some time. And I think that the result will prove that, again, you get away from the defaults. That percentage of emails that are getting through that you don't want will drop off fairly dramatically. Now, the last thing here that before we move off Office 365 ATP is this new thing that Microsoft announced about this automated response. Now, this is very interesting. So I think one of the things is that Office 365 and a lot of the Microsoft alerting technologies will do exactly that. They will give you an alert. They will tell you that go and check this. Someone's logged in two places they shouldn't have, or they've done impossible travel, but they don't actually take an action. So I think this new Office 365 ATP automated response will mean that once it detects an alert or something, it will then take an action that you have determined. So for example, if someone gets a phishing email that's detected or responds to a phishing email, then it can take an action. So again, rolling out at this stage, we've put the link in the show notes for you to have a look at. I'm waiting for it to hit the tenant so I can actually see what it does. But again, if you look at something like Cloud App Security, which is an add-on generally, in there, they've got the ability to do alerting via email, but also you can trigger a Microsoft Flow, which is very powerful. So you can go in there and say, okay, when this, and this happens, or I get this alert, take this action, disable the user, force them to do multi-factor authentication or whatever. So again, we're moving to a point now where it's beyond just reporting. I think we're getting to a situation now where there will be automated responses that will sort of take the fight back to the bad actors. So again, very interesting add-on here for Office 365 ATP.
I think when we're dealing with robots as well, we're not necessarily dealing with someone on the other end of the thing. We're dealing with a robot that's poking and prodding and trying to get access. You know, we have the technology now to find that, assess that, but do we have resource to sit there and watch that? No. So these automated responses, I think, are going to be the centerpiece of the next, say, 10 years, where people are just trying to automatically deal with these things because they need to spend those resources in other areas, not watching and responding if that can be automated.
Well, I think, again, like you said, the attacks are now automated. They're able to use scale to do this and do it efficiently. Therefore, the defense should be using exactly the same technology, and that's what these automated responses are going to be. We find those in a range of Microsoft products, and this is going to increase over time. So something worth investing in, but looks as though it's coming to Office 365 ATP. So it'll be very interesting to see how that works, how we can tweak it, what we can do to respond to some of these bad actors. Now, the other thing that I thought was the biggest news for Microsoft in the SMB space was that shared computer access has been announced for Microsoft 365 Business. So shared computer access means that you can now run Office on the desktop and allow multiple users to access that. So typically we see that used through something like terminal services or RDS boxes. That basically means you can put one version of the software on a terminal server, and then multiple users can access that one piece of installed software with their own profile. That previously wasn't licensed in Microsoft 365 Business, but Microsoft has confirmed with an announcement that it will be available basically from now, be rolling out to tenants. So I see this as a huge positive for Microsoft 365 Business. It now makes the Microsoft 365 Business product much better, I think, than the standard Office 365. And I think it will be the license of focus for many in the SMB. What's your take on this, Brenton?
Yeah, look, I agree with you there, Robert. At the moment, people are selling E3 for this express purpose. but maybe they're not using a lot of E3. Or maybe things like advanced threat protection and a few other areas of Microsoft 365 business that don't come with E3 are far better threat prevention technology than what's being typically offered in E3. I think it's quite positive. E3 has been purpose-built for the enterprise. M365 business has been purpose-built for that cloud first, born in the cloud, no on-premises necessarily, but maybe there's a little bit. That's really what it's all about. So I can just see Robert's chucked the link in there for me. Quite positive. And I think, when you get your business onto Microsoft 365 business and you configure it all properly, it's quite an amazing and powerful set of technology, really, for the sort of money that you're paying for it. It's even cheaper than E3, I think, from memory, Robert.
Yeah, I think, again, there's so many licenses and comparisons, but I think functionality-wise, now it's effectively at least functionality on par plus all the other additional features. So I think that, again, in today's world of SMB, where you need to manage devices, iOS, Android, do the security, do the email phishing and that, that's a lot of that stuff isn't provided in the base Office 365 E3. And again, it's been rolled into Microsoft 365 Business. So if you haven't looked at it, I think it's a great option to consider, especially when you're moving from an on-prem environment like the typical SBS environment with a third-party AV mail hygiene service and so on, but now you want to manage the devices using something like Intune and give that protection and also give that manageability. So again, if you haven't looked at it, I suggest that you go and have a look, but have a look at the link that we'll put in the show notes about the shared computer access that basically means you can now run on a terminal server, which makes it equivalent to what the licensing was in Office 365 E3. Now, the other big thing, I think, in announcements generally was the preview announcement of the Windows Virtual Desktop. So this has been a service that was promised since the last Ignite back in September. It was about 3 or 4 weeks ago. It was announced that it's now in preview, so you can go and play with it for free. When I was at the MVP Summit in Redmond, we had a lab session basically on the product where the people who developed it took us through how to set it up, get it running, show us what it was involved. My comments are that at the moment it's still very enterprise focused. It's still very technical to set up, quite a bit of PowerShell to run. It's not difficult, but again, if you're not comfortable with those technologies, you may struggle. The other thing to remember at this point in time that it needs a domain controller, whether that's a on-prem domain controller through a site-to-site VPN or a virtual machine that is running as a domain controller or domain services. But again, if you look at the roadmap, they will see this requirement disappear and you'll be able to connect it directly to Azure AD. But for the time being, in preview, Windows Virtual Desktop does need a domain controller. So keep that in mind. That does make it a little bit expensive to go if you want to go and play with, because again, you are still charged for the compute of the machines that you're using. But it's very, very impressive the fact that you can basically, once it's all set up, you go to the iPad, click on the icon for whatever third-party app you've got. It actually launches a terminal session in the background, runs an application directly on Windows 10 and to the user. Looks as though it's running on their iPad. So I see big future for this and something I think that people should make sure they keep an eye on. What about yourself, Brenton? What are your thoughts on the Windows Virtual Desktop?
Oh, look, I had a bit of a look on Reddit. Reddit lit up, obviously. r/Azure was the main one where they were talking a lot about it and people were quite confused about where it sort of sits. So I grabbed this little blurb from one of the guys there. He was saying, traditionally with remote desktop services, you had to run front-end services on an array of servers, a session host, a broker, and which also required an SQL database, a gateway that allowed RDS from outside of the network, RD Web, which provided the web interface to launch a session. So Windows Virtual Desktop takes away all those front-end services and puts them in a combination of Azure Cloud Services, Web App, Azure SQL, as well as modernizes logon experience using HTML5 and Azure AD. This allows for better security controls and cloud scale. They also added the licensing benefit of Microsoft 365, covering access of license to Windows 10 host in Windows Virtual Desktop, which could dramatically reduce the cost of licensing that the company's paying today. So it's not just a lift and shift. You can probably do that today without this. This is a fundamental different way of how it works, built on newer and more modern technologies. And people are really quite positive about it. But like Robert said, no one's really game to just say, okay, this is our core number one business system and we're moving everything to it tomorrow. But they're saying for what it does, people are very, very positive about it. So it's good to see. I think this is great. The more things we can move into the cloud, right, Robert?
I think you've got to look at it, basically think of it as an RDS box. So traditionally you would have a, something like an SBS box, and you have a secondary box, whether it's a virtual machine, that ran your terminal services environment. Think of taking that terminal services environment and basically running it as PaaS, platform as a service. So you bypass IaaS straight to PaaS, which means you don't have to worry about the hardware, the configuration, all the resources underneath, RAID arrays, all that sort of stuff, networking. You can basically configure the whole thing with a script, and then you only pay for what you use. So if the machine's running and the user's on it, you pay for it. When all the users come out of the system, you're not paying for it. So again, I think the scalability is also really powerful, this flexibility when it comes to pay on consumption. And in an environment where we have lots of trouble controlling the end user machine or device, are they on an iPad, are they on a PC, on their phone, giving them a consistent, secure environment is very important. And this is what this is going to allow. And again, what it means is that the control of this sort of environment goes back to the IT pro to make sure that they've got it secure. They can control everything because it's all in the cloud. They can access it. They don't have to try and reach out and log on to the end user's computer. So again, I think that's a really positive thing. It means that a user can basically launch a browser session and get access to it securely using Azure AD multi-factor authentication. So we're not so concerned what state the end user's device is in general. As long as they've got access to a browser, they'll be able to get in. We can secure it to make sure they get in. So we also will see this product licensed to come into Microsoft 365, both business and enterprise eventually. So again, a lot of positives here. And again, I think this is very much an indication of the way technology is going, like Brenton says, moving towards the cloud. And I suppose another way of looking at it is we're moving back to terminal days. So again, people just use a dumb terminal with colors this time to access all their technology in the back end of the data center. So again, there will be demand for it. There'll still be demand for people's PCs. But again, think about the situation where you only need a Windows 10 desktop to do a couple of things, maybe a third party app. And then you're good to go. So we'll put the links in the show notes. You can have a look at it. You can work out, follow through the steps there to get it up and running if you want. But if you're a partner, you're probably not going to have enough credits generally in Azure because of the hardware requirements to get it up and spinning. But if you want to spend a little bit, you can certainly have a look. My suggestion to you is that it will continually improve and we'll see it much easier. And again, hopefully remove the need for a domain control and have Azure AD Direct Connect. So again, keep an eye on this product, currently in preview. So it's all free for the actual service. You've got to pay for the Azure compute and storage and stuff. But again, keep your eye on it. I think this is one of these big game changers that will take a little while to develop, but certainly will give a major reason for a lot of people to move more and more of their workloads into the cloud. So again, we'll make sure the show notes are up there for you. With that, Brenton, why don't you choose another topic to talk about? What catches your fancy?
Oh, I was wondering if we're getting pretty late in the episode and whether we have to almost roll into another episode, Robert.
Well, I think we can probably extend it a little bit. I think our listeners will put up with a little bit of extra time given the fact that we have been away for a little while. So why don't we pick maybe one more topic and we'll talk about that, and then we'll look at winding up and, again, holding stuff over to our next episode.
Yeah, that sounds like a good plan. Well, we couldn't not talk about CREDG. I don't know if that's what people are calling it or if that's what Robert's calling it. This is the Chrome/Edge hybrid. So Microsoft made the decision that's going to discontinue development on Edge browser as the Chromium is open source. Grab that, customize it, make it work with all the Windows stuff better, and start from there. So you know, you can go out and get the nightly build if you if you're crazy, or you can get I think they're going to have a beta build, which
they've
is
got
a,
so what they've got is they've got two channels at the moment. They've got a canary and a dev build. The canary, as you mentioned, basically updates daily. The dev build, I believe, updates once a week. And down the track, I think probably towards Ignite, maybe a bit later on, maybe June to July sort of time frame, perhaps we'll see a standard beta. But at the moment, it's canary and dev.
Yeah, so anyway, so that's really positive, I think. There was a few grumbles around the community around you know, this whole groupthink mentality around browsers. All we really have is Chrome and Firefox now. People might remember Opera used to do its own thing, but I think that's now a thing of Chromium. And you know, you're going to get a lot of benefits from this. All the, you know, all the extensions built for Chrome already that already exist, the hundreds of thousands of whatever extensions that seem to exist, you can add them in. So, you know, LastPass support is one of the things that I was looking for in Edge. Wasn't there. I don't think it was in Internet Explorer 11 either. So, you know, using Chrome and having that natively in, Chrome works ridiculously well with all the Microsoft stuff. All the Microsoft stuff seems to really work well with it. So if it can bring in some of those functionalities, or like the single sign-on stuff or the identity stuff that Google's just nailed into Chrome, and you can have your own Microsoft version of that, I think it's going to be quite compelling, especially since I've seen what Google can do through managing a web browser. You know, you can push out bookmarks. There's about 100 or so different configuration settings you can set from the cloud, push out to a profile. You can push it out to security groups in Google. Like you can push out extensions. You can push out. So all of a sudden, we're going to have this ability that one of the biggest threat vectors in the organization and biggest productivity tools in the organization is now going to be manageable from Microsoft. I don't know how far away we are, but you know, the functionality must be built in because Google's doing this today. So I don't know. What's your thoughts on it, Robert?
I think it's an interesting thing. I think that basically the way it's going to work is that, you know, Microsoft's going to keep the two in parallel, but obviously it's keen to make sure that it goes forward on this new Chromium-based platform. It's been very positive what's come out so far. A lot of people are very positive in what they've seen because it obviously is built on pre-existing technologies like what we see in Chrome and other browsers. So as you mentioned, a lot of the extensions are already there. And again, Microsoft is now currently, like I said, in effectively the alpha phase before beta. So hopefully it'll continue and improve. But if it does what it's doing now, and again, it's stable. It's been very stable in the one I've been playing with, which is great. And they just keep adding features to it. This is going to be fantastic. But again, it sort of gets into a situation where it's, okay, hang on, Google are the gatekeepers. So Microsoft wants to push something in and then they've got to get Google to approve it. So this will be the interesting thing when you have these sort of two very competitive companies that do compete in some areas working on a common open source project. Let's see how it goes. But so far, so good. Again, if you want, you can go and download the install. It will run side by side with existing Edge, so you won't override or won't change your existing Edge. It'll just come up with a different icon, and I think beta, I think it has through the icon, so you can use it separately, you can play with it, you can see what it's like, get a feel for it, update it as you need, and obviously uninstall it if you want to. But if you're an IT pro, I'd certainly be recommending that you have a play with it on one of your test machines to get a feel for it, to understand what it does. But from what I've seen and the, what I've played with it and the people that I've listened to and the reports, it, again, basically is getting very positive reviews. So fingers crossed that Microsoft will, again, have a successful browser out there that people will want to use and be happy to use, I suppose, is the major question. And I've heard, interesting, here's another thing to consider, Brenton. Maybe our new Microsoft Edge browser and the Chromium project will actually run all the way back to Windows 7. Wouldn't that be a bit novel?
I hope not. what do we got now? We got app support. Everyone should be moving to Windows 10. I remember up at the Microsoft event that Robert and I were both at, you know, they're doing this massive push just to get people to Windows 10 because you've still got people on Windows 7. They think it's great. But the reality of it is it hasn't got a feature update in years. It's now going to end of life where it's not getting any sort of updates anymore. When I had Windows 7 in my environment, it was the biggest headache I ever had. Network interface cards would drop out. People go, oh, why does it do that? I'm like, well, because it's like the dinosaurs had one of these. You know, this is Barney Rubble computer. We need to move you into the future. It could be a hardware fault. Everything's that old. And they're like, oh, okay, well, we better go buy new stuff than it's computers. But, yeah, when you hear stories about people still trying to roll it out and, you know, XP is still good, you know, I need it for this or I need it for that application, and you're just like, gives me a headache, Robert.
Yeah, I think so. But it is very interesting that what's going to happen here, the change it make. And like you said, you know, there would be some benefit. You know, again, there will always be people who want to run Windows 7. Is it better for them to run more secure, up-to-date browser? And if they're just, yeah, be very interested to see. But I think, again, Windows 7 must die. There's no question. But, again, it is interesting whether Microsoft put something in the code that won't let it run. But we'll wait and see. So if you hadn't had a look, we'll put the link in the show notes. Have a review. Put it on a test machine. Have a fiddle with it. Brent and I are both using it. We'll give you reports and updates. But it's impressive what it has achieved so far. And I think that it's only going to improve from this point. I would expect to see a lot of information come out of Build. So Build, Microsoft Build is their big developer conference that I think is in the beginning of May, the first couple of weeks in May. So again, I think we'll see a lot of developer stuff around this new browser, and then hopefully the IT Pro stuff will roll out in September when we get to the Ignite session. So again, keep an eye on that. Now, there are lots of other things that we could cover, but as Brenton mentioned, we are approaching our time. We don't want to, again, suck too much of your precious time during the day. So what we'll do is we'll hold over some of these other stories till next time, but hopefully we've given you the most important ones. So again, shared computer access for Microsoft 365 Business, two options for ATP now, the new Microsoft Edge browser based on Chromium, and the Windows Virtual Desktop, I think, are probably the biggest news items that we've got on our list here too, haven't we, Brenton?
Yep, I think that's the big one since we last had the podcast.
Good. Excellent. So hopefully everybody's up to date. There'll be more stories coming shortly. And if people want to get in contact with us and see what we're doing, or maybe have some suggestions for us for what they want to appear on the show, how can they do that?
Hi, here we go. I should write this down, actually. So if you want to send us feedback, it's feedback@needtoknow.cloud. Robert and I are both on the Twitters, Director CIA, and contact Brenton. What else do they need to know, Robert?
Well, there's lots of stuff, so I will copy and paste it into the OneNote so that you now have it for future reference. So if they want to contact us via email, they can feedback@needtoknow.cloud. So that's needtoknow.cloud. And again, you can contact me on the Twitter @DirectorCIA. Brenton is @ContactBrenton. The show is @N2K podcast on Twitter and Facebook. We appreciate any feedback, any comments, and again, any publicity that you do provide for us there. We hope that everybody again is enjoying the podcast. Remember that you can always send us feedback, good or bad. We want to hear from our listeners, and we do appreciate everybody out there who is a regular listener and again has taken the time to obviously download and listen to these episodes, probably at 2 or 3 times the speed. So again, as long as you get through the content that works for you, that's what we want to see. What do you reckon, Brenton? I think it's probably time that we wrap it up and we start looking at producing this and getting this out as quickly as possible.
Sounds like a good plan. Thanks for listening, guys.
You have been listening to the Need to Know podcast from CIA Ops. For training on using technologies like SharePoint Online or Office 365, visit www.ciaopsacademy.com. By purchasing from the selection available, you'll be directly supporting this podcast. To provide feedback on this episode, visit www.ciaops.com/contact. This podcast is voiced and produced by me, Mark Keane.